Good morning from Holden Village, high in the Cascade Mountains. And today is June 27th, 1997. We have a session here that's going on by Ingrid Chris Johnson. And it's a short story reading and discussion of Salisbury Joe. But we are in progress. We're sorry that we got late on this one.
I was in the Army. Numbly, I nodded. She took her hands out of her jeans and squatted down by me. But you're doing it the hard way, she said, picking up a rag from the floor. Now watch. Expertly, she wound the rag around the first three fingers of her right hand, scooped a bit of brass cream from the can, picked up a spittoon, and rubbed its side in a slow circular motion. Then she stopped. See? You don't have to scrub at it. Just let the chemical do the work. See how it dries to a haze? Now you polish it. Joe was right. The place she'd done burned like gold. She set the spittoon down and rose to her feet. I still said nothing. I wasn't supposed to talk to Joe Kerner. You must be Johnny's oldest girl, Joe said, glancing idly around the shop. Where's your dad? I need a haircut. Joe looked at her hair, lank and stringy on her shoulder. I looked at her hair, lank and stringy on her shoulders. I guess he's gone upstairs, I muttered, trapped and kept on polishing. Is he closed? No, ma'am. Joe looked up at the ceiling. Well, she said, rocking back and forth on her heels, can you get him for me? Right then, Mr. Hardnacky walked in, stopped and looked at Joe, who gazed back at him. Mr. Hardnacky got a funny expression on his face. Joe smiled a little. It was Mr. Hardnacky who cleared his throat and looked away first. Your dad around? He asked me. Yes, sir. Oh, I scrambled up so quickly I banged my knee against the edge of the sink. I'll call him right now. I ran to the back, but this time, after I called my father, I waited at the bottom of the steps. For some reason, I felt I had to warn him. My heart pounded, and when he came clattering down, I grabbed his hand and tugged. He stared at me, surprised. In our family, touching was reserved for punishment. What's the matter with you? He said. Papa, Joe Kerner's out there. She wants a haircut. What? Mr. Hardnacky's out there too. Papa said, Jesus Christ, and hurried into the shop, with me right behind him. Joe and Mr. Hardnacky stood on opposite sides of the big room. Hands deep in her pockets, Joe nonchalantly examined the startled deer heads my father had brought to hang along the back wall. Mr. Hardnacky was assessing the potted geraniums and rubber trees that had been in the window for as long as I could remember. Low art, Papa said heartily, acting just as if he didn't notice the tall, skinny woman in jeans and shirt right in front of his face. What can I do for you? He whipped out the barber sheet and snapped it smartly in the air. The works? Joe said, excuse me. Mr. Hardnacky and Papa both froze as if some masked and slit-eyed hoodlum had come in and said, this is a stick-up. Mr. Hardnacky still had one leg, the leg he was going to use to step up into the chair, in the air. Slowly, both men turned their faces to Joe. Slowly, Mr. Hardnacky's foot lowered. Joe stepped forward, smiling. I think I was first, Johnny. Papa looked mad and scared at the same time. First? First? What for? Why, for a haircut. Joe passed her fingers through the lank strings along the side of her head. Sure, I'm getting shaggy. My father drew himself up. With great dignity, he said, Joe, I can't cut your hair. Why, you ought to know better than that. Why? I need a haircut. This is a barber shop. You cut hair. Well, because this is a man's shop, Joe. You don't belong in here. Joe's face went white. Since when is hair male or female? She said. Lord, Johnny, I just want a haircut and I'll be on my way. Her voice had sharpened. Even I knew there was something going on here that had nothing to do with haircuts. If you're worried about rough talk, I won't cramp your style. I heard plenty in the service, and I don't have lily ears. Papa shook his head. I'm not doing it, Joe. I don't cut ladies' hair. Why don't you go on down to Doris's on Van Deventer? "Because I don't want my hair permed or palmed or curled," she answered, and her hands were out of her pockets now and hung loose and big and red at the ends of her bony wrists. "I don't want my hair bobbed or tweaked or twisted or styled. I just want a plain old haircut, just a haircut like you give." "Go someplace else for it. You can get one someplace else. Cheaper, too." My father charged 65 cents, but he was a union man. "I don't care about the money." She flung an arm up and pointed out the window. "Why should I have to go somewhere else? Look, you're right across the street. We're neighbors." "Sorry," Papa said. "No can do." He turned to Mr. Hardnucky. "Come on, Art, get up in this chair." Joel Kerner threw her arms wide and muttered, "Damn it to hell anyway," and stalked from the shop. Mr. Hardnucky giggled. "That beats it. That really beats it," he cried, laughing out loud now. "Got a foul mouth for a woman, don't she?" Papa grinned. When he told Mama, however, Papa acted solemn and weighty, as though he'd successfully turned aside some danger. He tisked and shook his head. "It ruined her, the service," he said. "Women have no business in there." "Oh, Johnny, lots of women went. You can't tell me they all came back strange. Besides, she was helping out our boys. Our girls, more like it." "Shh." "Art says his cousin's girl came back that way from the waves. It ruins them, the service." "My mother, who spent what little leisure time she had in reading all kinds of books bought from the Goodwill for a quarter a box, leaned her chin on her hand and said, maybe the service doesn't change them. Maybe it's just getting out of here. Maybe they go off to do one thing, and while they're doing it, they learn something about themselves. Maybe they're already that way and just don't know it or know how to be it." She looked at Papa's frown. "Not that I think it's right," she finished quickly. "That kind of learning nobody needs. She should have stayed home and gone to work at the airplane factory if she wanted to help out in the war so bad. Now she's walking around looking like little Abner asking me for haircuts. Jesus." Mama, eminently practical, said, "Well, we could have used the money, Johnny." She patted her swelling belly. Papa stared at her. "You know, Rita," he said, "sometimes you don't have any sense at all. I don't want her in my shop, get me?" 65 cents, my mother said, "a pound of coffee and 3 cents change." She could be stubborn sometimes. But, like a bad penny, Joe came back. This time I wasn't around, but I heard all about it in bits of gossip from the stoops, in snatches of conversation between my parents, in tag ends that Papa and Mama told Aunt Lottie and Aunt Irene and Uncle Ted and Aunt Jenny when they came for their weekly visit to Babcha. Joe came back the Friday after Papa sent her away. She must have picked late Friday on purpose because Friday evenings were Papa's busiest time. On Fridays, Papa kept the shop open until 9 to accommodate all the neighborhood men who wanted sprucing up for the weekend, but didn't want to interrupt their weekend free time, especially if they only had a half day off on Saturday. Fridays, from 5 o'clock on, there would be as many as 9 or 10 men waiting their turns inside, and sometimes 2 or 3 sitting more comfortably on the long iron step that ran across the front of the shop. And the shears and clippers and razor would be silver blurs in Papa's hands. On Friday evening, Sandy and I couldn't play downstairs until the shop was closed. Things got too raw, what with all the cigars and chewing tobacco and swearing and man talk. Into this 50s bastion of maleness, Joe Kerner bravely strode. And once again, everything stopped. Joe went to the cash register on the back bar and laid a half a dollar, a dime, and a nickel on top of the brass drawer. "I need a haircut, Johnny," she said. "I'll wait my turn." Papa glanced around the room, embarrassed and mad, but before he could say anything, Dale Otto called out, "What about it, John? Shall I give the little lady my chair?" Some of the men laughed, and the ugly feeling that had begun to loom in the corners of the room fell back a little. Yop stood up. With a flourish, he offered his seat. "Miss Kerner, ma'am, would you care to park yourself?" Now all the men were laughing. It was going to be all right. Joe said, "No thanks, I'll stand." Someone said, "Those are good-looking pants, Joe. Where'd you get them pants? I might buy me a pair." Someone else said, "Them your army pants, Joe, or did you have to look for them?" "Hee hee," the men went. "Ha ha," they brayed. Mr. Prater wiped tears from his eyes. Joe stood there and took it. She looked straight ahead of her the way a cat does when it's looking at something people can't see. Papa was laughing too, but he said, "Come on, Joe, take your money and go. You're not going to get a haircut here." Yap hollered, "Give her a shave while she's at it, Johnny." He collapsed into guffaws. "I want my haircut," Joe quietly repeated. "Short all the way, clippers on the back." She nodded right at Yap in his fresh do, like his. "Hey," Yap cried, his laugh fading out. Papa said, "Joe, come on, go home, okay?" "I don't think I will just yet," she said amiably enough. "I want you to cut my hair. My money's as good as anyone's." None of the men were laughing now. Jerry Haney, who worked in the slaughterhouse at Cray's and had always smelled faintly of blood and strongly of chewing tobacco, heaved himself to his feet and walked over to stand facing her. "Look, girlie," he said, "I don't know what you're doing, but why don't you do us all a favor, including yourself, and get the hell out of here?" Papa said, "Jerry, she's a woman. I don't need trouble." Haney swung his bull's head toward my father. "I know she's a goddamn woman. Being a man, she'd have had some business in here." He turned back to Joe. "Now, I don't know what you think you are, but since you're a woman, I'm asking you nicely. Take your money and go, okay?" "No, I need a haircut." Haney stepped back, aimed, and let a thick stream of spit and tobacco juice fly from his mouth. The wad landed on Joe's right shoe and ran slowly down to the tan linoleum. "Get out," he cried. Joe looked at her shoe and then back at Haney. "After my hair gets cut," she answered. But there was a fine tremor in her voice. "Ah," Haney bellowed, his neck swollen, his big face purple. He grabbed Joe's collar and right arm and spun her around toward the door. As he did so, her face cracked into the coat rack and blood suddenly bloomed on her mouth. "I warned you," Haney muttered. And then he said something that I would hear over a decade later and more than once. "You want to act like a man? I'll treat you like a man." And he half pushed, half flung her through the door. Joe staggered, her arms pinwheeling, but she didn't fall. She stood on the sidewalk, panting, holding her hand up to her bloody mouth and looking in at the shop. "God damn it, Ann, anyway," Haney said. He scooped up Joe's haircut money and flung the coins at her from the doorway. They rolled across the sidewalk and spun into the gutter. Haney sat back down, grumbling. "I didn't mean to hurt her," and began to whistle softly. Papa said, "Hell, Jerry," and shook his head. Eugenie C. craned his neck past the plants in the window. "She's still there?" Papa asked. "Nah, she's gone on home, I guess." There was a little silence, a little sound of shoes scraping on wooden chair rungs, and change jingling in pockets as men shifted in their seats. Then Yap brought some humor back. "Josephine," he grinned, "ought to be Joseph. Then we could call her Joe all right, with an E on the end of it." Papa laughed uneasily. "Well, I don't know why she's picking on me." And his scissors wove deftly around Dale Otto's head, clipping at the clumps of waxy hair growing from Mr. Otto's ears. Yap chuckled. "Maybe she likes you, Johnny." They all laughed then. Mr. C. said, "Playing around, huh? Rita's gonna kill you, John." In high spirits now, Haney settled cozily, spat a brown string into the nearest spittoon and said, "Well, that's that, I guess." But it wasn't over. I'm not sure why Joe chose to make her stand against the whole neighborhood, or having done so, made it at Papa's barbershop. Maybe she just wanted a haircut, and when she was refused, bristled with the injustice and had to try again. Maybe there was more to it. By throwing out her challenge, though, Jo Kerner turned an uneasy truce into a situation of gleeful and scandalized harassment. Now, when she passed, the women muttered shame or hissed at her back or loudly called their little girls to their sides and put protective arms around them. Men catcalled or whistled at her or cried, "My, my, ain't that sweet?" Or sometimes, "Hey, fella, where you going?" Jo would set her angular jaw and keep on walking. What else could she do? The neighborhood boys soon saw nothing would happen if they tormented this odd-looking adult. When Jo was foolish and uppity enough to buy a second-hand Buick, some of them snuck out one night and wrote dirty words in soap on all its windows. Next morning, there she was with a bucket and rags scrubbing away so that she could drive to work. A few mornings later, the words were back. Mrs. Kerner rarely came outside, not even to go to Mass or the store. Jo stayed away from church. She did their shopping on Saturdays, going to Perky's like everyone else. Food and haircuts were different. Anybody had the right to buy food, after all. Jo's hair was crudely hacked off at the ears now. It looked awful. She had taken to wearing a striped engineer's cap all the time, the bill pulled down low over her nose. The cap and the way she wore it made her lean face cocky and unreadable. Papa said Mrs. Kerner must have cut Jo's hair, as no real barber could do it that badly, even if he tried. He wondered if she wore her railroad cap while she was working. Then he said he was surprised she still had a job. Mama said that maybe Jo was just a very good worker. Then Papa said maybe they didn't know she was a woman at the can company, or how could they give her a job with so many veterans out of work? Patiently, Mama pointed out that Jo was also a veteran. "God damn it, Rita, you know what I mean." We were all at the supper table. "I never knew anybody like you for sticking up for underdogs. Niggers and Hoosiers, they're bad enough without you taking up for queers. What's the matter with you, anyhow?" He jerked his head toward Sandy and me. "How'd you like to be Mrs. Kerner and wind up with a kid like that?" Mama regarded us calmly. "That could never happen," she said. Forgetting myself, I spoke up. "A kid like what, Mama?" Papa, head dog, growled at me from across his plate. "When a puppy eats, it doesn't bark." Faced with the logic, as well as the warning, in this familiar maxim, I shut up. In sympathy, Sandy reached over and dumped a spoonful of her gravy on my peas. "Johnny, can we drive out to Irene and Lee's this Sunday?" Mama suddenly asked, changing tacks. She lifted her dark red hair away from her neck with both hands. There were blue circles under her eyes, and her pale, freckled skin was moist. "It's so hot," she complained. "Maybe it's cooler in the country." "We'll see." Papa reached for more bread. "We'll talk about it Sunday." Papa never liked to go very far from Salisbury Street, unless it was with his friends from the shop. Just to get him to go for a drive to Fairgrounds Park or to the river, Mama had to start laying her plans well ahead of time. But by Sunday, Papa had something else on his mind, and even Mama admitted this was important. Veraldine Prater, of the ripe buttocks and insolent breasts and Betty Grable legs. Veraldine, who was still single at 23, while all the neighborhood swains pined for her. Veraldine, with a good job at Sticks, Bear, and Fuller's department store downtown, whose least trip to Perky's was gratefully noted by every male within range, who went out alone and returned home alone several nights each week, but who stubbornly refused to accept a date with any of the local men. Veraldine, to whom all the women were always so sweetly polite. Veraldine Prater quit her job, packed her bags, and boarded the train from Union Station for California. Mrs. Prater was at home, crying. Papa and Yap and some of the other men took Mr. Prater over to East St. Louis, where it was legal to drink on Sunday, and went out drinking to console him. Mr. Prater must have needed a lot of consoling, because when Papa rolled in that night, he made so much noise that Sandy and I woke up. Papa seemed to be having a hard time getting in the house. It sounded like Mama was helping him up the steps and trying to shush him at the same time. Once he said, "Son of a bitch," and once he said, "Get away from me, Rita, or I'll break your arm off." Finally, Mama calmed him down. We heard his body hit the mattress in their room. Then he groaned and muttered for a while, Mama making soothing noises. And then we heard what must have been his shoes falling one by one to the floor. Above our heads, Babcha's feet shuffled. Then her rocker began creaking hard. A chain of Polish words drifted down to us. Babcia was praying for the soul of her son, who would surely be a paragon of virtue if he had not, in some madness of heart or loins, married an Irish woman. Down in the backyard, Papa's watchdogs were barking hysterically. Under the glow from the street lamp outside our window, Sandy and I knelt in bed, our knobby knees touching, and stared at each other. "Drink of water," Sandy pled. She always wanted a drink when she woke up at night. I sighed and took her hand. Together we trailed down the long hallway to the kitchen. I reached up and pressed the button for the light. Mama was sitting at the table, holding her head in her hands. She looked at us standing there in our panties. "What?" Mama said. Overhead, the old lady's rocker creaked on. "Sandy wants a drink." Mama nodded, went to the sink, filled a cup. Sandy took a few swallows. "Now go to bed," Mama said, taking the cup. "Go on." On our way back down the hall, we heard another noise. It sounded scary. It sounded like Mama was crying. The next day, Papa opened the shop an hour late. First, he sat at the kitchen table, drinking cup after cup of black coffee. His eyes were red. His hands shook. Mama told us to stay out of his way, don't make noise, and don't say anything to him unless he talked to us first. I thought of the fat razor strop hanging under the counter in the shop and nodded quickly. Feraldine's exodus, so abrupt and so dramatic, not at all like moving into her own flat, which would have been back and bad enough, kept Salisbury Street occupied in the days ahead. Some people thought she was in trouble and abandoned. Others opted for elopement with a secret beau. The phone wires and the front steps, stoops, crackled with conjecture. Monsignor Lubalai, who hadn't touched the subject of Joe with a 10-foot pole, preached a sermon on the prodigal son at 11 o'clock mass, which sent Mrs. Prater to openly bawling. In the shop, Mr. Prater was the object of solemn sympathy. Joe was shoved to a back burner on the scandal stove. Later that month, when a for sale sign bumped gaudily on the front wall of the Kerner's house, it was noted with satisfaction but little comment. As for Papa, all he said was that Joe and her mother were probably moving downtown, where the gypsies lived and anything went. People were still busy gabbing about Feraldine. In the next days, a thin but steady parade of prospective buyers trudged up Mrs. Kerner's snowy white stoop, spent 20 or 30 minutes inside, and then trudged down again. Mostly, these were very young couples, sometimes with a child in tow. Then one couple returned, but this time they brought an older man and woman along. From where I was busy drawing a picture of Straight Arrow on the sidewalk with blue chalk, I watched them enter. A long time went by. I had finished Straight Arrow and was working on his horse, Tony, when the young couple, the older man and woman, and Joe came outside. They stood talking for a few minutes, then Joe and the man shook hands. The strangers piled into a big sedan and drove away. Joe pulled the for sale sign down from the wall. Carrying the sign, she went back into her house. I ran upstairs. Mama was feeding clothes through the wringer. "Mama, Mama, some people were at the Kerner's house for a long time, and when they left, Joe took the sign down." Mama dried her hands on a rag and hurried to the front room, where the sofa and the two big chairs stood. She leaned out the bay window and stared across the street. "See, Mama, the sign's gone. Is the house sold?" Mother nodded. "I guess so," she said slowly, and looked some more. Then she sighed and said, "It's best." Why is it best? Nobody had ever, ever sold their house on Salisbury Street, not that I could remember. "It just is," she answered, turning away from the window. It was almost time for school to start. Sandy would be in kindergarten and I was starting third grade. Mama took us down to 14th Street and bought us new shoes. Sandy got two new dresses. I didn't get a dress because from first strict grade on at Holy Trinity, girls wore navy blue pleated skirts, white tops, and red ties, all bought from the church. The boys could wear whatever they wanted. But I did get a school bag and a new pencil box, so I was happy. One Saturday morning, Joe walked back into the shop. "Morning, Johnny," she said. She nodded to the men sitting around. Then she turned to my father. "Guess you know we sold the house." Papa nodded warily. "Reason I'm here, the truck'll be by this afternoon. We'll be gone by tonight." She smiled. "I really don't want to leave without one of your famous haircuts." Her hand went up to pull off her railroad cap. "I look so bad," she said. Papa shook his head. "You know better, Joe. How about if I give you something extra? I do admire your cuts." Joe reached into her jeans and pulled out a handful of silver dollars. The men watched quietly as she laid $3 on the counter. "How about it, John?" Papa looked at the money and then at Joe. He didn't say anything. Joe waited a second and then added two more coins. "$5, Johnny. What do you say?" He looked at her butchered head and then at the waiting men. "I can't, Joe," he said. "I don't cut ladies' hair." Slowly, Joe added 5 more coins. $10, John. Almost 15 haircuts. Helplessly, Papa eyed the money. Then Yop spoke up. "Hell, if she wasn't that bad, give it to her, Johnny. A haircut, I mean." Joe smiled. Another man said, $10 is $10. Lot of money for a haircut, John." Someone called out, "Hell, I'd do it. Go on." Papa, absolved of guilt by a jury of his peers, shrugged and scooped the coins into the cash drawer. "Okay," he said, "but all these guys are ahead of you." Joe nodded, but the man Papa had been working on stood up and took the barber sheet from around his neck. "Do me later, John," he said. "I want to see this." Joe climbed up into the chair. Papa whipped the barber sheet around her neck. "How do you want it?" he said, all business now. "Short, clippers on the back, burns. Can you repair the mess?" she asked, squinting into the big mirror over the back bar. Papa laughed. "Sure, I'm the best there is. I'll give you the best cut you ever had. Girl, you just paid me for 15 haircuts." He looked around at the men. "Hope you guys don't mind, but this'll take a while." His thumb indicated the cowlicks and the unruly patches and the places where scissors had cut deeper than the surrounding hair. While he worked, the men watched with real interest. The shop was very quiet. Papa had become the consummate professional. His fingers flew. He grimaced with concentration. Now and then he stood back from the chair and closed one eye. Then he would step forward, take a tiny snick here, tuck a hair into place there, and go on. 30 minutes later, when Joe finally stepped down from the chair, the top of her head was crowned with a perfectly angled crew cut, tapering beautifully down to a close-shaped back and sides. In front of her ears, her high cheekbones sported sideburns that looked like they'd been drawn and not clipped there. Papa had outdone himself. Joe looked sleek, arrogant, and a little bit dangerous. Joe stood in front of the big mirror, gazing at her profile and at the back of her head, angling the hand mirror Papa offered her. She grinned. "I like it. It's good, Johnny," she said. Papa, pleased by his work and by the money in his till, was inclined to be friendly. "So where are you moving to?" he asked, using the whisk broom on her shoulders and back. "Oh," she waved a vague hand, "out a ways." "Well, no hard feelings, okay? Say hello to your mother." "No hard feelings, John." Joe pulled out yet another silver dollar, and this dollar she pressed into my father's hand. Papa stared down at the coin. "What's this for?" "Your tip. Take it," Joe smiled. "It was worth it." That afternoon, a truck pulled up at the Kerners, and 3 men climbed down and went into the house. They began hauling boxes and trunks and mattresses and furniture out to the truck. By dusk, they were done. Joe came out and spoke with them for a few minutes, and then the truck lumbered away. Joe's Buick still sat at the curb. A couple of hours later, when people filled the stoops and the kids ran back and forth, when Papa had just closed down, joined Mama on our own stoop, and opened his first bottle of beer, Joe Kerner came out of her house again. She wore a navy blue pinstriped double-breasted suit over a white shirt and a plum-colored tie. Her black wingtip shoes were polished to a high gloss. The cuffs on her trousers broke just right over her insteps, and a white handkerchief, Chief, drooped rakishly from her breast pocket. A carnation rode in her lapel. On the sidewalk, Joe paused, struck a match, and lit a cigarette, then dropped the pack and matches into her jacket. Still standing in the wide white glow of the entry light, making dead sure everyone could see her, Joe took a deep inhale of smoke. Then she put her hands in her trouser pockets, and with the cigarette dangling from the corner of her mouth, Joe Kerner strolled down the block. Past the knots of silent men and women, Joe Kerner ambled. At the corner under the street lamp, she stood for a moment, as if drinking in the fine, soft, late summer night. Then she crossed the street and strolled back up the other side of the block. When she reached the barbershop, she nodded at us and went on. Under the street lamp at our corner, Joe stopped again. Raising her head to look at the sky, she turned in a full circle. She leaned one arm lazily against the lamppost. Her other hand snapped her cigarette away. The cigarette made a high, bright arc in the air and came down in a mist of sparks. After a bit, Joe straightened her shoulders, looked up and down the block, and crossed the street at an easy lope. When she reached her own house, she went swiftly up the stairs and inside. The street was so still, you could hear the cicadas chirring from the little park a block away. A moment later, the door to the Kerner house opened again. Mrs. Kerner came out, followed by Joe, who carried a suitcase. Mrs. Kerner walked to the Buick, her freshly permed head held high. Joe opened the door for her mother, threw the suitcase in the back seat, and went around to the driver's side. She slid under the wheel, started the car up, switched on the headlights, and pulled out. At the end of the block, she gave a couple of farewell beeps on her horn. Stunned again, Salisbury Street watched until Joe's red taillights winked out in the distance. Sometime that fall, the mailman brought an envelope to the shop, addressed simply to Johnny the Barber, 2027 Salisbury Street, St. Louis, Missouri. When I came home from school, the men were passing it around. They didn't look happy. As I walked through the shop on my way upstairs, Jerry Haney dropped the envelope. Automatically, I stooped to retrieve it and the snapshot that slid from inside. Though Papa snatched them from my hand, he wasn't quick enough. I had already seen. In the picture, Joe Kerner's Buick was parked somewhere with a beach in the background, with people in bathing suits lying on towels. Beyond was water, and there were people swimming in the water and a far-off sail. In a blinding white t-shirt, her short hair sleek, her face tanned, Joe Kerner leaned against the front fender of her car. Her left arm lay draped across her mother's shoulders. Her right arm was around the waist of Verldine Prater. The camera caught their smiles perfectly. So there you have Salisbury Joe. I sometimes wish now that we could have all the pages in large print.
For closer examination.
Yeah, because every time I read it, I find it so many more things. There's so many layers. Well, what do you think? How did it make you feel? What did you like or not like?
I suspected the ending.
Did you? Who said that? You said that. You did?
Mm-hmm.
Well, why else would the author have done that description of Geraldine Prater if the author wasn't going to use her at some point? There had to be a reason for injecting her in there. The description of Geraldine Prater, which is a paragraph about that long, is all one sentence, which is quite an interesting... I haven't figured out why the author did that.
How old is the author?
How old?
Yeah, it was a marvelous period piece.
Wasn't it?
Describing a small neighborhood in a large city. That was one of the things that caught my attention.
Mm-hmm. I loved that. I thought it was really a nice description of detail. Why? Now, I think that's really important. Why were there so many details? Why did we need to know so much about the time? Do you think there was a reason? I mean, aside from the fact that it makes fun writing. She was born in 1939.
Okay.
It says, Frankie Hucklin Brioche, born in 1939 of second-generation working-class parents, grew up in a solidly Catholic German-Irish neighborhood in St. Louis. When she was 18, her parents, horrified at her sexual orientation, invited her to leave home for good. Since then, she has rocketed around the country from Miami to Los Angeles, from San Francisco to Las Vegas, from Denver to San Diego, working as a car hop, a waitress, a carny barker, factory worker, bar owner, and college graduate. She knows what jail is like and what it is to live alone for a year on top of a mountain. I just thought that we wouldn't if we didn't remember what it was like in those days, or if we weren't taught, if we didn't live then, that the all the stuff about all the social construction of the attitudes toward homosexuality wouldn't have made sense. It's one thing to have a sort of physical construction, but it's another thing to do a social construction. And obviously, the attitudes about homosexuality were what the novel was about, but I don't think it would have rung true without the... Deanne?
It's also interesting that all of that's done in the past tense. Because she could have told it as if it were just happening.
Mm-hmm.
But that past tense draws it very vividly, but gives us this distance.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way it used to be. Mm-hmm. That's how it used to be.
Mm-hmm.
And to do that with those details about even the way she something about the way she described the people sitting on the stoops, and even the women would drink a cold beer, you could just imagine what those beers were like, you know? That they were, that you mentioned that they were cold, and I was thinking in St. Louis, they're probably really what they were like there. So that seemed so real, like you were there, and it makes you think about the non-material things she's describing.
Mm-hmm.
How much is that different, and how much is that the same? With this chronological distance that the past tense gives.
Mm-hmm. And lesbian life several decades ago was much more characterized by people playing of roles, butch mm-hmm. and femme roles. When the mother, the mother has the voice of the wise person in some ways through, and the mother says, well, maybe they leave home and in order to, or while they're gone, they learn how to be who they are.
Mm-hmm.
And in those days, you would have learned how to be butch or femme often if you were a lesbian, and so that too was of the time to be real stylized. What about costumes and clothes and what people wore? What costumes popped out at you?
And well, just a description of. Especially how Joe was dressed, were so vivid. I mean, just at the very end, the blinding white t-shirt that she had on. Everything was really vivid, strong
mm-hmm.
imagery for clothes.
And then she came home in a uniform, and then she wore her factory clothes that were another kind of uniform. But the housewives, and the little girl tries to picture what Joe would look like in a house dress, because she thinks of that as the uniform of the housewives, and how if you're a married woman, you have to wear house dresses. And then the naked woman, one of the most proper and pious women in the block, the picture of her being naked and running down the street is the single most outrageous thing she could do. Seems like there was another...
School uniforms,
yes.
Well, and that the girls wore school uniforms and the boys didn't.
Mm-hmm.
Which seems, that struck me as an inaccurate detail. I couldn't imagine that was really the case, and yet it's important in the story to have that be the case.
Mm-hmm. In Chicago, it is surely not the case now in all the Catholic schools. I don't know how it's been. And the nuns' uniform was described quite detailed, and that had that same white in it. And the masked hoodlum, she was likened to a masked hoodlum when they were trying to say, to express the depth of the danger that she presented. So there were lots of use of clothing. We didn't know much about what the men wore. Do we know what any of the men wore?
Probably overalls. Just that work outfit of hers.
Yeah.
I felt like they described the women, and then by describing what Joe was wearing, that was what a lot of the men would have been wearing.
Right. I remember wondering if the men would wear a suit like that she strolled around in.
It's interesting, the flourish of the cape, you know, that you can see, you know, going around the room, and that's the only clothing item you saw. Was,
mm-hmm.
you
know,
the barber cape.
The barber cape, and with the flourish, it was kind of interesting.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's talk about danger for a minute. The various kinds of dangerous people, the expressions of danger, what were people afraid of, who had courage in relation to danger. The butcher, the guy that was the in the shop and physically hurt Joe and was made his living slaughtering, worked in a slaughterhouse, was the sort of most articulated expression of somebody being violent. And he pushed her out the door, and she had a bloody mouth and stuff. So that was a sort of characterization of him almost as an animal. So that was one form of danger. Did you hear other danger language?
I was struck by his saying, "I didn't mean to hurt her."
Mm-hmm.
He deliberately hurt her. Mm-hmm. When she was outside, "I did not mean to do that."
Mm-hmm. And he said it in a complaining voice.
Mm-hmm. See, it's
like
a
she made me do it.
Yeah, she
like
made
she
me
brought
do it.
It on herself. Yeah.
And I've known people like that, so I don't know if it's my prejudice or not. He's also the American way of solving problems. You beat it up and destroy it. But on the other hand, I've grown up in the neighborhood where there is that bully. So I don't know if it's just a character or is it meant to portray something beyond that.
I didn't see that as courageous, though.
Oh, no. It just is.
Yeah.
We solve problems by beating up.
Yeah. Took it in steps. First of all, just the verbal threats. And I felt like if any of the peers in the shop had protested, then he would have stopped, but by their not protesting, it was permission for him to go a step farther. So, on the reverse, when she got her hair cut, it was the peer permission.
Mm-hmm.
That plays a huge effect over the acceptance,
mm-hmm.
or not.
In kind of a way, she's really just kind of flaunting at the barber and the whole group where their values are. I mean, when it got to be $10, well, I guess we can sacrifice our very strong moral, stand when it finally got to that. So she was throwing in their face.
Which would be the equivalent of how much money for a haircut these days. I mean, if it costs 65 cents then, what would $10 be? I was trying to figure out how much of a bribe.
15 times. Well,
$15.
Like $150?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wow. So you'd throw away all your scruples for that.
Minimum. Right. That's a good point.
But, this violence thing, I think that the father was drawn from the beginning as being a really volatile, creepy guy.
Yeah.
So I was always worried. And I'm surprised that the narrator didn't get more beat up in the process of all this for being in the wrong place at the wrong time. Although she seemed to kind of know the ropes, so she figured out how to...
Mm-hmm. She was beat up mentally.
Well, and hit and slapped and hit and strapped.
Yeah.
And she said, the only kind of touching in our family is hitting, is
punishment.
But in a barber shop, a lot of touching goes on. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, if
and
he...
But, or the father.
And the rest in that barber shop, it's the male barber touching the male client, customer.
Yeah, I mean, how many...
Unless you ask why a barber shop, well, that barber shop is a man's place, which means it's only men who are there together. It's very camaraderie, a lot of camaraderie.
And physical, I mean,
very physical.
Shaving and you know, all the stuff. The works, whatever the works were.
And with a razor.
Right.
Dangerous.
That's what I thought of, too. She gives that glinting of the razor in the sunlight, too. The instruments of a barbershop.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty dangerous.
But the danger, the main danger language in here was danger that Joe presented. They experienced her as being extremely dangerous.
Like when the mothers would call their kids over, their daughters, and put their arms protectively around them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that that they perceived that as danger, and I think that the butcher probably felt himself very courageous to do what he did. But of course, the she just shines to me as being courageous to be able to do what she did.
Mm-hmm.
She could have just left it many times.
Mm-hmm. And slunk away.
Yeah, talk about tenacious.
Right.
Man with a haircut.
Yeah, she was clearly I mean, I thought her courage was...
Mm-hmm.
She worked it out, too. She thought about what she was doing, and she had a plan, and she was deliberate. And I mean, at first it was a justice issue, I think, just, I want a haircut, you're my neighbor, we're in this community together, we live across the street from each other, we've known each other all our lives, why can't you cut my hair? Hair is hair. But it got to be much bigger than that immediately. And the slaughterhouse man was deliberately portrayed, I think, as sort of the epitome of the kind of testosterone of people who are afraid of her. So if she was the biggest danger, he was the biggest defender, you know, so there was some kind of a, you know, picking the most extreme example of the guys in that neighborhood to protect them against the danger that she supposedly presented. And she kind of managed to defuse all of that, finally.
I admired Mama and the way she stood up to Johnny. Not aggressively, but just very gently. Well, maybe something... Maybe there's a different point of view.
Mm-hmm.
And his reaction, of course, was always vociferous.
So a lot of the power in the community was held by the power of opinion and the power of the social structure. And she was able to kind of compromise or see another way. And he was saying, you know, basically I'll lose all my business if I cut this woman's hair. So, you know, there was some kind of fear like that.
I would have liked a little more relationship between the mother and the 8-year-old. I'm sure there must have been a very positive relationship there.
Yeah. Yeah. And that scene in the middle of the night, for example, was kind of a cozy and respectful. It wasn't, the mother didn't get angry that the girls came down for a drink, even though the mother was having a private breakdown at that point.
I'd like to see the story almost more set in our contemporary, like Dan kind of brought out. It's easy for us to say, well, that's the way it was in the past. And I had something that I struggle with in my workplace. One of my colleagues at work is a lesbian and has a home domestic partner. And, you know, she... well, actually, right now she doesn't, but she has a friend partner, I don't know, that she, you know, spends every weekend with. And she makes a big thing. You know, she's always excited on Friday when I leave, and I'm going over to Seattle, I'm going to see Stacy. And we're all, you know, what's there's nothing wrong with that. That's wonderful. And if she it was her boyfriend, everybody would be going, oh, hey, how was your weekend? You know, and did you have a good time? Oh, good, you know, I'm glad you're going. And is she coming over this week? But that, in our office, we're uncomfortable with that. We just are not. And why does it have to be that way? Why can't we be happy for Judy that she has a relationship? I would want my colleagues to be happy for me. Mm-hmm. Somebody sent me flowers. Great, who'd you get flowers from? Mm-hmm. You know, but with Judy, it's kind of a resentment, or it's just a different attitude. It's not that. It's just a strange thing, and I struggle with that. I just want to be able to, but I'm afraid to ask her, how was your weekend? And I'd like to think I'm pretty enlightened.
You're afraid because of other people overhearing? Or
No, it's just I don't know what it is.
You might get a friend if you spoke that way.
Well, the point of view that Deanne was pointing to about the kind of distancing effect of having it all be in past tense in this story has more layers to it than that, I think, because the author kind of looks at us and twinkles, or, you know, the author is making jokes about how odd or funny this is, or, I mean, there is some humor in it looking back on the situation as an adult. So the author is clearly distancing herself from when she was eight, but I think the author is telling it with such a heartfelt persuasion that there's something poignant and difficult and sad, and there's a justice issue here, in a way that tells me, at the time this story is written, which was 2 or 3 years ago, this is, you know, the author is acknowledging this is still a problem in our society today.
And that's in whatever way, it may not be exactly the same way, but
right, it's still. I mean, the author herself, we learn in this little bio, was thrown out of her own house. It's still a problem. Chuck, did you want to say something?
Oh, I can't help but paraphrase something that was in the Lutheran a year or so ago. It talked about health, and it said, basically, if after a serious illness all that you have is restored health, you've been cheated. And I think of this story now, if after this learning opportunity you still have the same attitude, you've been cheated. I mean, we're slow learners. Yes.
For me, I guess, it asks a question of, by presenting itself first with something that so much of us long for now, and this is this community, and we keep looking back, thinking to what community was and our sense and lack of it, and yet juxtapositioned against that is, when you have community, how do you embrace diversity at the same time? And that, having lived in community now for 2 years here at Holden, that's been a struggle for us always, and it's a constant question that we ask. And you have so much of this looking back to the good old days when we lived more closely, we lived more intimately, but so often the flip side of that is the need to make everyone conform, the need to set these rigid structures in place, these rigid rules that to be accepted and embraced in this warm and loving group, you had to sacrifice so much of yourself to be there. And how do you envision and how do you create community then that still has the sense of identity and the sense of warmth and the sense of belonging without the exclusive quality to it, without the frightening rigidity that comes into it.
Mm-hmm. And that's where I think we're not only slow learners, but there is something in human nature that mm-hmm. wants people to conform. Mm-hmm. We want to understand each other. You're like me. Well, and then when people really aren't like you, that is harder, I think, and always will be to a certain extent, no matter how enlightened you might feel like you are.
Like Barb preached about in Vespers yesterday evening. Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. I have a lesbian daughter, and I'm happy to say that after her partner left her after 10 years, several of my friends asked me, how would we be doing without mm-hmm. Helen?
Oh, good. It seems such a small thing, but somehow mm-hmm. we're so grateful mm-hmm. for small things in this area. Mm-hmm. Well, we've gone way too long, but I appreciate your
thank you.
Comments.
Thank you. Thanks.
Yeah. Are the other stories in that book similar?
Yeah, it's a great book. There are a series of three of these books, Women and Women 1, 2, and 3.
One of our daughters, we have a lesbian.